Just Energy Radio with Dr. Rita Louise. What am I made of? Why do I get sick? How can I live a more balanced and whole life? These are just a few of the questions that will be explored tonight by your host, naturopath, medical intuitive, and clairvoyant Dr. Rita Louise. Call in and talk to Dr. Rita and her thought-provoking guests. Get the help you need to move beyond any obstacle or challenges affecting your life right from the source. And now back to Just Energy Radio with your host, Dr. Rita Louise.
Hello and welcome back to Just Energy Radio. I'm Dr. Rita Louise, and thank you all for staying tuned to the second hour of the show. So in this hour, we're going to be changing gears and talking about the secret prehistory of America. And to do that, we'll be talking with Frank Joseph, another guest of our show earlier. But let me tell you a little bit about Frank, and we'll get him on. Frank Joseph is the author of a dozen published books about metaphysics, military, and ancient history released in as many foreign languages. A feature writer for Fate, Command, and Atlantis Rising magazines, his article about military aviation have been published by the Department of Defense. So please welcome to Just Energy Radio, Frank Joseph. Hi, Frank. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, not a problem. You know, I think it's very interesting in your bio how you write, you know, military aviation and topics about military and then jump into metaphysics and ancient history. And I don't know, my brain just kind of has a hard time wrapping around both topics.
Well, not really, because I believe that our whole species, I was going to say civilization, but I think our whole species is moving towards a kind of an integrated mode in which the interconnections amongst so many apparently different things that we thought were so separated in the past, now there are commonalities that are emerging, that there are common themes that link one into the other. And as far as writing about the military, I can tell you that that has a very strong bearing on what happened in America during prehistory, because there were civilizations that got to the point, they had begun quite well, but they got to the point where they were so consumed with self-gratification, with self-indulgence, that they would do anything to keep those endorphins up. And as a consequence, they became aggressive, imperialistic. They made war on their neighbors. And in the long run, they destroyed themselves. And so
we wouldn't happen to be talking about Atlantis or anything here.
I'm talking about America, actually.
Oh, okay.
but
I thought we started off imperialistic as soon as we got here.
No, we're headed in that direction now. But, and I'm not really talking about America. I'm being rather facetious. I'm talking about trends that are dangerous in our country, and that really even the difference between Atlantis and America begin to merge, because it's part of the human condition. And we have to make a choice. I think that's what history and archaeology are telling us, is that it's important to make a choice between the self-destructive modes of thought that begin out of fear and selfishness, or else to go back to those higher principles of being close to nature in every regard that made civilization great when it started.
So were you listening to the first hour of the show? Because that's almost exactly what we talked about.
Well, that's good confirmation, but I don't want to bore your listeners with the same thing. So,
Well, no. I mean, it was just kind of like, were you having like a little psychic moment on me there, Frank?
Channeling your show.
That's right. You were receiving it on airwaves in your teeth. Yeah. So you have a new book, Unearthing Ancient America. So when did this come out?
Not too long ago, just a later part of last year. It's a collection of what I think are the very best articles that have appeared in our magazine, Ancient American, over the past 18 years or so. And it was my privilege to collect these really outstanding articles and put them into a format that's accessible and easy for people to read like myself who are not professional archaeologists, but we're interested in, of course, the where we came from and who we are, what happened on our continent before we got started, and are these energies that were unloosed long ago still working with us? All those are questions that are addressed in Unearthing Ancient America. And it covers a very wide spectrum. And there's very little theory in this book. It's mostly hard facts, real strong physical evidence of people who arrived here in large numbers long before Columbus. Not a couple of dozen years or 100 years, but thousands of years before Columbus. The people swarmed from various parts of the world, from the from West Africa, from North Africa, from Western Europe, from Asia, and made a tremendous, dramatic impact on the prehistory of our continent. And that's basically what the book is about. And it presents not just theories, as I say, or somebody's conception of things, but artifacts that were left by these people that are not discussed in the mainstream press.
Yeah, so what's with that whole thing? You know, why don't... I mean, you know, I got the book before we even had set up the interview, and I'm like, oh, Frank's got a new book. I'm going to flip through it. And I was like halfway through going, huh? Never heard about that. Huh? Never heard about that. Huh? Never heard about that. I mean, and I feel that I'm pretty well read, you know, especially in, you know, ancient history and stuff. And I think I heard about two or three things that you talked about in the book. So why haven't people heard about it?
It's not surprising. There are a great many people who are quite well-read and are familiar with, they think, with the history and archaeology to some extent. But their sources of information have been through mainstream press. And the reason why we do not hear about these things is because, believe it or not, there still are claims out on American territory from other parts of the world. And so this is one of the reasons why these ideas are not discussed. I mean, for example, we know for a fact, and it's one of the articles that are published in the Unearthing Ancient America, that the Portuguese were here before Columbus. Now, they were not here, of course, hundreds or thousands of years before Columbus, but nonetheless, they were here decades before Columbus, at least one decade before Columbus. In other words, sometime in the 15th century, they were here. And what would that do to our relations with Portugal? There are places where Christopher Columbus is regarded as a saint. If you go to Brazil, for example, Christopher Columbus is just about popularly canonized. And when things are found down in Brazil, for example, a Roman wreck was found, a Roman ship was found off the coast of Rio de Janeiro about 15 years ago. It was verified by archaeologists from the University at Maine. The cargo on board was identified to a collection of amphora or vases that go back to the 1st century A.D., right around 40 A.D. And when that wreck was found by a fellow by the name of Marx, and he announced it to the Brazilian authorities, they pulled a cement barge over the site of the wreck and dumped the cement barge on the wreck. And it is impossible to access that anymore because the paradigm would have been shattered. No longer would Christopher Columbus be regarded as a saint. Of course, that's Brazil. People think, well, that could never happen here in the United States, but it does happen here. It's not as crude as that, except that information such as we have in Ancient American is not discussed on the mainstream television or taught in the schools. And part of the reason is there are outstanding claims on territories in the United States which could theoretically be revived. That's one reason why. The other reason is that when you go to school to become an archaeologist, you are told to support the research of your fellows. And in order to do that, you cannot put out anything that will shake up the research of your colleagues, because they have a financial investment in the way history is taught. That financial investment is they publish their own textbooks, which they sell to their students. That's part of their income. It's also part of their ego, a big part of their ego. I found that mainstream archaeologists are not interested in the prehistory of America. The only thing they're interested in are tribal histories of various Indian tribes But when it comes to, for example, like the Adena, which I'm sure our listeners have not heard about, the Adena were a people who are recognized by mainstream archaeologists that burst on the scene in America 3,000 years ago. And these people built pyramids. We're talking about stone pyramids. They introduced agriculture. They were iron workers. They had iron foundries. They came out of nowhere. Genetic testing on some of the people that were related to the Adena or lived in that area in Ohio, the Ohio Valley, have revealed that the Adena came from Western Europe, specifically Normandy in France, in Ireland and Southern Britain, that these were Celtic peoples who were displaced by the advances that Rome was making and sailed the North Atlantic to, in large numbers, to create the first real high culture here in North America. And
in
their
Ohio?
DNA, yes, in the Ohio Valley. They settled in the Ohio Valley. And they landed, first of all, of course, along the eastern seaboard and traveled to the Ohio Valley because it was extremely rich agriculturally. And the society that they set up, the Adena set up, these are Celtic people now. They set up, it lasted from about 1,000 B.C. all the way to 700 A.D. That's when the last of them were exterminated in wars with the native tribes. These stories have been told amongst Native Americans for many, many years, but it's only been recently, within the last 5 years, that the DNA testing has revealed that the Adena were, in fact, people from Ireland and Southern Britain and Northern France, and yet that's not information that is discussed on television. It completely dismantles the paradigm that there was nobody here before Columbus, nobody of any significance.
Well, but that's rude. And, you know, that's politically incorrect. You know, what was interesting, I read your book, and one of the stories you talk about is the Kensington Runestone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I thought it was an interesting article, and I'm going to let you kind of talk about that here in a second. And when they talked about it, they were like, oh, well, this guy found it in his backyard, ha ha, supposedly, but it was determined to be a fake.
The Kensington Runestone was found by a Swedish immigrant farmer in the middle of Minnesota while he was clearing his land. And as he was pulling up a dead tree to get it out of the way of his plow, he found that the roots of the tree were entwined around a large granite boulder. And the boulder was inscribed on three sides with runic script. The runes were used by the Norse as late as only about 200 years ago in their own language. The runic language goes back many centuries, of course, but it flourished during the time of the Vikings and sometime thereafter. And here he is in Minnesota, and he pulls up this runic text on the side of this great boulder. The runic text was easily read. It was found to be in archaic or older Swedish. And so there's no trouble translating this text. And it tells about an expedition of Swedes who left Sweden and made an exploratory voyage, as it is explained, to the eastern seaboard of the United States, North America, then traveled down the St. Lawrence Seaway. Part of it they had to portage over land because it was not as accessible then as it is now, all the way into the Great Lakes, and made it into Minnesota through a system of rivers which no longer exist. River system has been proven to have existed at this time, which is about 1421. Columbus discovered America, 1492. We're talking about 1421. This is beyond the Viking Age, but the Norse were still sailing Viking ships. They were Christianized by that time. They were no longer the Vikings that we know with the so-called horned helmets and things like that, which they never wore anyway. But so this voyage of discovery tells how when the Swedes arrived in Minnesota in 1421, they were attacked by local tribes. Five of their party were killed, and that the stone was set up as a memorial to those five who died. And it has since been learned that this stone tells about a people who left Sweden not just for kicks, but they had been commissioned by the king of Sweden to find a place of refuge, because in 1421 there was a massive epidemic that was sweeping through northern Europe and was decimating the populations, especially of Scandinavia. And the king of Sweden was looking for some place where he could get away with his royal family, someplace far that nobody had heard about, nobody knew about before, get away from all possibilities of contagion. The Kensington runestone, when it was found in 1898, was labeled almost immediately as a fake. So it turns out the farmer had the misfortune to be Swedish, so people thought he was responsible for the Swedish fraud that was in the, with these runic letters. However, as recently as just 2 years ago, Scott Walford, who is a professional geologist, had access to an extremely high-powered electron microscope. And this is a, I'm cutting to the chase here, but he did a, an electronic microscopic survey of the runes as they appear on the stone itself, the stone that was found in 1898 in Minnesota. And it turns out that the grooves under the electronic microscope reveal that they could only have been carved about 500 years ago, between 500 and about 800 years ago. They were not carved in recent times because of the wear involved. Also, it was found that the tool marks made on the stone were not by modern tools, but they were not steel tools. They were older iron tools that had been long out of service, no longer used by the time that Olaf Ullmann, the discoverer of the stone, found the stone. So the Kensington runestone has been absolutely verified through scientific analysis to be an authentic piece of physical evidence that shows that there were people from northern Europe who had made a voyage of discovery and had penetrated as far as Minnesota in 1421. You're not seeing this in your education. Is this going to rewrite the history books? No, it won't, because the paradigm is still in place. Nobody before Columbus. When you go to school, as I said, you are told that is the nothing is accepted about any overseas visitors to the North American continent before that time period. That is a time, what they call an event horizon. Refers to Columbus.
Well, you know, you kind of have like Leif Erikson, sort of, but not really. You know, and I just think it's interesting because when you talk about the tablet that was found, you know, that supposedly had a description of work being done in the Second Temple or the First Temple in Israel, I mean, everybody jumped on top of that thing, and they did all kinds of tests only to find out that it was a fraud, you know. And so why, you know, it just seems like a disparity, you know, in interest where something like that, you know, there are all these scientific minds looking at it and testing it and evaluating it and determining its authenticity, and then something like this, they just immediately say, oh, well, it's fake, without really doing any testing.
Well, when Scott Walter, the geologist, made his determination that this Kensington runestone is authentic, that it does portray Swedes who arrived in the early part of the 15th century, it did make the front page of the St. Paul Pioneer Press. And they did present some of his evidence. However, they immediately, and on the newspaper, they went to a mainstream archaeologist who completely condemned the entire stone as a fraud, made a big joke of it, and most of the article was about how the state archaeologist thought the thing was really quite funny, but the state archaeologist had been presented by Scott Walter with their findings. The state archaeologist took no interest in it whatsoever. They have the attitude that because nobody could have been here before 1492, nobody was here. And that mindset absolutely predominates, and it's impossible to convince these people. The only way that there's going to be this new history that we're talking about and that the book is all about will really be accepted is when this present generation of academics has passed away. There are some archaeologists now, younger ones, as it turns out, in their 30s and 40s, who are taking a serious look at this information now and are not condemning it as a complete fraud. We've had, not this issue of Ancient American, but the one just before it, the last issue of 2008. We were contacted by the archaeological department at the Field Museum in Chicago, which is a major archaeological institution, and they were very sympathetic. They helped us out with a lot of great new finds that they showed us. They gave us fabulous photographs, which we were able to put in our magazine for free, just to get out their information, and they had no trouble associating with our magazine. Before, when Ancient American first came out in 1993, Oh, the archaeologists regarded it as, well, I think somebody once said a scientific pornography. Something not to be examined, you know. So, but it's kind of funny that they chose that word because I knew for a fact years afterwards that there were many archaeologists who were reading our magazine in secret. So it'd be just like, you know,
going
some,
and getting an inquirer.
Right, some wicked little kid, you know, going in the closet reading a Playboy magazine or something. It's on that same level. But, there is definitely a change, a shift going on, and, I think that our book, Unearthing Ancient America, has got to get a lot of these skeptics thinking, at least halfway of an open mind anyway. But the Kensington Runestone is absolutely hard proof, granite proof, that there was an expedition that did penetrate as far as Minnesota that long ago.
Well, and there, you know, it would be one thing if it was one thing, you know, just that one stone. But, I mean, the book is just filled with story after story after story after story of different things. And, you know, all they would need to do is investigate one or two, you know. Like one of my personal favorites, which I just kind of shook my head at, was the underground city of the Grand Canyon.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
That is a
romance. You know, and I just, and so if you could talk a little bit about that whole find, because I was just like, what underground city of the Grand Canyon? And, you know, people have gone there, and it's not in any of the tour maps.
No, and the reason why it's not on the tour maps is because it's in a very dangerous area of the Grand Canyon. The story was that somebody had found an underground city in the Grand Canyon, and that this guy had been associated with the Smithsonian Institution of all groups. And so this is pretty interesting, and that's about all we knew sometime in the early 20th century. So we telephoned the Smithsonian Institution, said, what about this story? I said, oh, we get calls every once in a while from people say that supposedly this Egyptian city was found in the Grand Canyon, but it's all a hoax. It's, you know, we don't know anything about it whatsoever. So we did some research into this story, and we found that there was a fellow by the name of G.E. Kincaid, who was a photographer, a professional photographer for the Smithsonian, and had been, in fact, hired by the Smithsonian in the year 1908 to make the first photographic record of the Grand Canyon. He had already been hired by the Smithsonian for other projects. Kincaid was of the level of Ansel Adams. He was one of these great nature photographers. And in late 1908, Kincaid by himself set out in a boat down the Colorado River to photograph the Grand Canyon. He was only the second human being to have ever been through the northern part of the Grand Canyon. Not even the Native Americans would go there because they regarded this area of the Grand Canyon as cursed. And one reason why is because it's extremely dangerous. It's a very treacherous area, and it's forbidden for people to go into this day because it's very hard to rescue people. You cannot get a permit to go in there. So Kincaid is going down the river making his photographs when he sees, to his amazement, up the side of a mountainous area, actually, a cliff, a set of what appear to be steps, a grand staircase carved on the side of this mountain. So he docks his boat and he pulls up and walks up the side of this mountain, and in fact finds that here is a grand flight of steps, stone steps. What's amazing, of course, about this is that, so far as is known, no one had ever been there. And he was only the second person known to have gone through the Grand Canyon, the first photographer. So he climbs the steps. The steps lead up to the side of the mountain, which opens up into a cave, or cavern actually, a large cavernous mouth. And he enters the cavern. He brings along with him his facilities, his lights and so forth, and he makes a tremendous discovery.
Okay, let's save the discovery till after the break. I'm Dr. Rita Louise. We're talking to Frank Joseph about his book, Unearthing Ancient America, and we'll be back after these words from our sponsors.